Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to Try Love. It is a literal roundtable podcast where we talk about movies or people we... Oh, sorry. Brett, I've done this 270 times. Still can't get it right every time. Movies we saw or people we met at or through the Trilon Cinema. I'm looking at my own face now, and it's totally fucking me up. At or through the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. You can find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. My name is Jason Daphnis. I've helped make this show for a few years. You can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I'm Cody Narvison. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison.
I'm Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
My name is Aaron. You can find me also, unfortunately, still on Twitter at RBPlease.
I'm going to introduce you for you. I'm going to steal your thunder right before you even get to talk on the podcast. Brett Berg, actually, this is a good test for me. Did I read your LinkedIn correctly that your current title at AGFA is Theatrical Sales Director at the American Genre Film Archive?
Correct.
And the founder, can I say founder? I guess I didn't see your title on the website, but at the Museum of Home Video, what do you call yourself there?
I'm the creator and VJ at the museum.
Excellent. Love that. So you may know Brett from the Trilon's calendar. Brett is going to be presenting Museum of Home Video's two presentations, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Ring Ring and A Guide to Infomercials in mid-March here. We're recording before time, which we don't usually do, but we're going to try and get this one out so people can get hyped and check things out. I know I've got my ticket. I think I got to see it Saturday. So we will definitely be talking about that over the course of the conversation. Thank you so much, Brett, for being on. Anything that we can point people toward right off the bat before we get into the conversation and probably lose track of any plugs we want to make?
Sure. So Museum of Home Video is a weekly live stream that's a found footage fantasia on the subject of show business. And it's on Tuesday nights from 9:30 Central onwards, 7:30 p.m. Pacific. And it's at museumofhomevideo.com.
Wonderful. Check it out there. You'll also find a link in the show notes. We were going to ask if you would just give us a quick summary of MOHV, and I'm going to hashtag coin that abbreviation if nobody already has MOHV, and giving us just a summary for anybody who might be unfamiliar with it. I think that was a great pitch already. I'm going to ask one of Harry's questions just to get things started off. What do you think keeps people coming back to the Museum of Home Video? What is it about the experience that sort of like makes them repeat visitors?
Well, I think it's a drug without drugs. And it's well accompanied by drugs if you happen to have like a drink or a joint in your hand, what have you. It is television with all the boring parts cut out, I guess is a simple way to say it. But it's a variety show. It's kind of like Weird Al's UHF meets college radio, where I get on every 20, 30 minutes and I say, you just saw this weird thing. You're going to see these next weird things. And it's talk show clips, it's game shows, it's commercials, it's local TV ephemera, it's satellite junk, it's me taking a movie and cutting it down to 12 minutes, because that's the only way I'd want to show it to someone rather than a boring 90-minute thing. It's new content creation, strange wormholes, it's all these things doled out like it's 60 minutes or it's MTV or something.
The new from the old, so to speak. Yeah.
And I started doing it on July 20-something, 2020, at a time when I had originally was thinking about doing a live show and then like, whoops, can't do that. Well, there is this thing called Twitch. And we were on Twitch for a couple of years and then we had to leave because they told us get out. And we now broadcast on our own URL. And it's not just my show on Tuesdays. We do have plenty of other shows. Like a music video show called Music Videodrome. It's twice a month. We have a monthly kids programming show called Playtime. So we have a New York-centric one that's monthly called New York Nights. I really did take a lot of inspiration from Weird Al's UHF, specifically the scene where they've got the programming board behind them and they're coming up with 30 different fake weird shows. I was like, I want to do that. So I get to do that now.
Follow your fucking dreams, which is a rule I did not offer off the bat, but swearing totally cool on this episode if you're interested at all. I do want to get into more about MOHV and your work, specifically what's playing at the Trilon, and a lot more, actually. No spoilers, but we got some real woo-woo questions, as Harry called them. But I do want to like tie it first. Local angle, we're Minnesotans. We're, adoptive Minnesotan anyway over here. We're locals. We've got to have the local angle. Tell us about your connection to the Trilon. How do you know John? What are you doing here?
I've known John and Barry for probably 10 years. I used to be a programmer at a venue in LA called CineFamily, which isn't around anymore. And we used to go to this annual conference called the Art House Convergence. And it was an annual gathering of people who ran indie movie theaters and also indie distributors. And, I just met them there and they were really fun people. And then I became a distributor. I hopped the fence, And, just the Trilon has booked many, many movies for me at AGFA, because what we do theatrically, you mentioned my job title earlier, we are the theatrical representation for all the other labels like Arrow and Severn and Vinegar Syndrome and Troma and Shout Factory and Cult Epics. So whenever someone wants to book a movie that appears on one of those labels, they ask me. And so we facilitate them with a movie print or a DCP, or they have the Blu-ray and we sell them fine. You can just share that if you want. We're this interesting nonprofit air traffic controller between the labels and the movie theaters.
Yeah. Fingers on the strings, right?
Yeah. I had spent 7 years being a programmer at the local level, and now I sort of still participate in many shows in a different way. John and Barry have always been very supportive of me and of AGFA. And it was really a no-brainer for me to come to the Trilon to do something as my first jaunt of Museum of Home Video in town.
So like Jason said, I'd love to talk more about Museum of Home Video, but first, what attracts you to that sort of work, to being a film distributor or a film air traffic control, like you said? What do you like about that?
Well, you don't have to work with any filmmakers. That's a plus. sometimes they can be needy. Now, I love films and filmmakers, but I really like dealing with their afterlife because it's a lot less complicated. I also have never gone into production myself. I've not been a competitive person. So getting into production seems very like sharky to me. And I used to manage a video store in the 2000s. And this is, so it was going from video store manager to cinema programmer to film distributor. And it just seems like a logical progression. A to B to C. Even though I had no clue that any of these things were careers, and nor did I choose it necessarily. It just sort of happened.
I, not to show my ass too much, but I listened to an episode of the Screen Slate podcast that you were on at the beginning of 2023, if I remember correctly, where you were talking a little bit about like the sort of wet titles of curator, showman, presenter, what you are to Museum of Home Video and in a lot of aspects of your capacity at AGFA. Do you like that part of it? I guess we've talked to some other folks who like find themselves either drawn to or sort of like phobic of the, I need to get up and actually sell this thing. I'd rather just be in a booth emailing and discussing and restoring. I'd rather do the like background work than be in front of the thing. Do you like this being in front of, do you like being on podcasts about these things? I guess.
I don't mind. Because I have a background in college radio, I did that for 10 years. That was concurrent to the video store stuff. So I was on KXLU in Los Angeles. I had gone to Loyola Marymount University. I'm from LA and I didn't want to leave town to go to film school. It just seemed weird of an idea. And I ended up at LMU and they happened to have this college radio station, which is heard throughout all of a major radio market. So I sort of grew up doing that. And when I started programming, it just seemed like it was part of the job. Like interfacing with the public is the job. You can have a desk job part to it, but I feel like it's not complete and you're not doing it in the best way you know how if you are not a human face of the organization shepherding these audiences through an ongoing experience, which is not just the night that they came to, but like you want them to come back. That's how you become successful as a venue. It's your venue is known, and the Trilon totally fits into this. It doesn't matter what they're playing. You're going to trust them enough so that whatever you go to see is an experience you want. It's the reason why you're doing this podcast. It's like, it's one of those places. So, being a programmer has to come with a public facing component, or else you're doing like 2/3 of the job.
That links up with one of Jason's next questions really well, because it strikes me that that's also such an interesting part of the Museum of Home Video, right? Like you show reruns on your Patreon, but it's a big part of it is the live experience, right? And that's something you really want from the experience, want people to experience. Why is that? What do you think is it about it that makes it a live thing more than it, you know, more than a recorded experience? What's that speak to?
Well, I originally just my love of radio, funny enough. Like growing up in LA, there's like a gazillion radio stations to listen to if you're a kid. And this is back when terrestrial radio was like still a thing, you know. I just got fascinated with turning the dial and sort of hearing these voices from different corners of the world. Harry Shearer has an NPR show. I mean, he did it on NPR for like 30 years, and I was an ardent fan, going from like fan of Spinal Tap and The Simpsons to that. I listen to a lot of talk radio for no reason. I'm glad I don't anymore, because it's like the last refuge of a certain kind of personality. And then when I fucking started doing college radio, it was just like, well, this feels natural. It's because it's like stuff I care about. If I didn't care about the stuff, if it was like me doing ad reads, it wouldn't work. But just that. And then a love of movies got shoved into it. And I used to be in vans. I don't know. It's just like what makes us human.
I promise we'll actually talk about Ring Ring and the other stuff that's playing at the Trilon from MOHV. But that does segue pretty cleanly to, I did find that you have been in bands before. You actually talked again. I read maybe a couple pieces about your work and some stuff that you've told other outlets in the past. You talked about like how the structuring of these things of MOHV specifically is like is musical, in like you don't want to abandon attention. You don't want to ignore the fact that like you might be losing people if you are like watching a screening of a thing. Maybe people start to dip and not pay attention. And that's how, you know, that's a point to bloodlet, so to speak. How do you know? Like, is it just continuously like trying to improve that process, or how do you know that a piece is going to be like for an audience, and do you ever tailor it for that audience, or is it just like what you know, what you're passionate about and what you love is now what you rely on?
What I'm passionate about is half of what I rely on, like the past knowledge of having seen something on TV in the past, like, oh, as it comes across my radar, yes, I know that I need to grab that and put it into my flow. But honestly, the what I do is greatly informed by me having been a venue programmer and having watched endless movies with the audience. And then I'm sitting – now, this is perverse. This is like mad scientist territory. But I would sit in the booth, because there was where our place, we had a little like alcove where you could sort of be with the audience, but you're like 15 feet higher than them, but you're still like in the room technically. I would watch movies with the audience, and I would look over them and see how they would shift in their seat if something got boring, or like if something really exciting happened, would they actually sit up in their fucking seat? And we also used to cut a lot of original trailers for the venue. And I feel like many times it's like, fuck, it's 4:00. I got to cut a trailer that needs to play tonight at 7:30. Fuck. And then, so I make it right there and I put it on for the audience, and there's an instant feedback. So the process of me broadcasting on my channel replicates that kind of instant feedback, because the people are in the chat box. They're like, I like this, or get it out of here. Or, you know, when someone has recently passed away, everyone pays tribute to them in the chat, you know, that thing. So I just love the mad scientist quality of all the things that I do, because it's in the spirit of learning and how to get better and how to make it like a more refined experience.
I was kind of going to ask about the kind of very internet kind of chat, you know, focused side of the show, because on one hand, the show is, it seems like this sort of retro kind of thing, right? This kind of collection of various different minutes of, you know, talk shows and movies and old kind of weird commercials that like you vaguely remember in the back of your brain. But that's kind of like also mixed through this very like, I don't know, kind of new feeling way of interacting with this kind of media, right? Which is like watching this at the same time as other people through this streaming platform. Like, is that an aspect of, you know, apart from like that kind of feedback, is that an aspect that you value, or is that kind of just like a bit more of a practical means to deliver this content?
It was practical during the pandemic, the lockdown era. And what my show did was it brought to the people who watched it was a return to appointment viewing, which is something that's leached out of our daily lives. And it goes back to the radio thing. You have to be there in order to see it or hear it. And I just carried on with it. And I just really enjoyed being people's Tuesday night. And now that the lockdown era has passed, hopefully there's not another one. There, people's viewing habits are different, and I have to shorten the show sometimes in order to like make sure that people aren't getting totally burned out, or I'm not commanding too much of their attention each week. Leaving wanting a little more. Again, constantly tinkering, constantly trying to make it a little bit better viewing experience. And also, these live shows that I'm doing are really just sort of R&D for future shows, where I've gotten into the groove of years worth of doing live shows again. I've taken for the trial on stuff, I've shortened a couple pieces because I know, oh, you know, I didn't play that well that last time. I'm going to shorten it. So
interest. I'm sorry, Harry, I'm going to cut you right off. I'm half an Indeed pistachio cream ale deep and I'm already off the rails, but I do like, again, I was really interested in like, what kind of reaction are you hoping for from these trial and presentations? I mean, we're actually now into the meat of the discussion about these things. How have you already talked a little bit how you've tailored it for, you know, your next audience. What sort of reactions are you hoping for from Ring Ring and Goddamn Infomercials? How have you built a thing for these, you know, meek milquetoast Midwesterners?
Well, with Ring Ring, it's a compilation of doorbell cam footage. Actually, it's a compilation of doorbell cam compilers, because there's a whole subculture on YouTube of people who just take people who add their own music and sound effects and narration to existing doorbell cam footage that has gotten off of Nextdoor or Reddit or wherever. And I hope people take it as a legit horror movie, because it's fucking terrifying. Not only the weird human behavior in front of the camera, but also the privacy implications of Ring cameras. You know, police departments sometimes have access to this stuff without needing a warrant. It's like, it's not what I think people are signing up for. So I hope it raises more questions than it answers, and it does feel like a creepy Michael Haneke style movie. Yeah.
Can I ask just about, like, you know, that sort of focus stuff versus maybe some of the other stuff that you might show from time to time, such as kind of the older, you know, 80s, maybe 90s kind of TV clips and whatnot. I mean, there is something like very interesting to me about like the kinds of stuff that you might show and how that changes based on like the era that it's taken from, right? Where like, you know, there's all sorts of weird, you know, like the Gorbachev, you know, Pizza Hut commercials and whatnot that aired like back in the day that are like, you know, kind of viral moments now. And like, I feel like you don't get as much of that cultural weirdness, at least through kind of formalized media channels anymore. Or that's my guess, I guess. But like, you do get, you know, everybody has smartphones now. Everybody is recording videos of what's going on around them. There are, you know, Ring doorbells and whatnot. Do you kind of notice, like, you know, if you're like building a show, maybe a themed one like this, or maybe just more like a kind of a general show, do you notice like a difference in like what kind of media you're attracted to based on what, you know, decade it's from, whether that's more recent or more in the past or anything like that?
Like, what is it about each decade that compels me to like include it?
Yeah, it was kind of a botched question, so if you could save me. Yeah.
Well, I don't really do much stuff from before the 60s. I find television from the primitive era of TV to be just not, it doesn't work well with my editing style. My editing style is to like quicken the pace. Kind of like, well, actually, I got this from Frank Capra from Screwball Comedies. Now that the sound era was upon them in the 1930s, people like Frank Capra decided to speed up the dialogue. Early sound films, they all talk like this, and then they wait for the next person to talk. But by the time, you know, like the front page and all of the Billy Wilder stuff and the Frank Capra stuff, they managed to get people to talk faster. And when I listen to podcasts, I put it on 1.2 times speed, just because that's the best way to appreciate it in my brain.
Highly contentious among this group. I'm at 1.5.
Oh boy. You lose the personality at 1.5, but you get the info. That's true. 1.2 is like you keep the personality and it picks it up a little bit.
we have like, at least I have this, like maybe too interested interest in how your, like, this current programming. And full disclosure, I haven't had yet the opportunity to tune in to MOHV. I, like Aaron, am signed up for text alerts, so I'll be catching the next one I can. But in context of MOHV's, like, usual fare, maybe talk a little bit about how Ring Ring plays into that. Because I don't, is it, like, are you usually trawling those same sources, you know, the compilers of doorbell cam footage for this kind of stuff? Or is it primarily for stuff that's usually like, I guess I got on the idea of usually it seems like it's informational or promotional material, commercials or clips from movies and things that have been produced with purpose, as opposed to, you know, these, like you say, intentionally kind of creepy looks at personal lives or like personal property, personal places. How does it contrast and compare with what MOHV usually does? And where have you sort of drawn the line in your own mind of how you program something like that?
The reason I put the doorbell cam thing together in the first place was I found it very cinematic. There's just something poignant about like the Bellatar-esque, or just like, you know, whoever had, you know, lockdown long take cinema, you know, whoever your director of choice is. And it's just very cinema. I mean, I omitted things that I thought were just flat visually, even though they were funny. And because it's supposed to be a horror movie, I had to cut it in such a way that kept the suspense burning for as long as I could. And what I usually, tying back to the previous question of Aaron's, which I didn't fully answer, sorry about that. the things from each decade that I look for are the most cinematic things that can be put into these weekly presentations. I find that that's what keeps people's attention spans locked in. And so from the 60s, I would say like documentaries are really interesting to do because that's where a lot of avant-garde stuff was filtering down into, you know, broadcast wise. In the 70s, I love game shows because of their outlandish cinematic Tim Burton Wonderland type sets that they have sometimes. It's also sketch comedy from that time. The 80s is like music videos or MTV itself or like late night TV. That's what really got interesting. 90s. Actually, and throughout all these eras, commercials. I find commercials poison my brain so much that I just have to process it in this way of finding the greatest, best, most cinematic commercials ever. So I think Ring Ring, the whole concept of doorbell cam footage fits in is because that's what people are watching now rather than broadcast TV. You know, they've got their ad and then they got the fucking YouTuber and then like 8 minutes later it cuts to some ad and that's what the people are watching now. So it's all grist for the mill.
Yeah. This is like my nerdiest question probably, I guess, but like speaking of grist for the mill, this has to be like an unbelievable, like, labor of passion for you, right? Like what is the process of editing between shows look like? I mean, how much of this stuff do you have to sort through? And like, how often do you, I mean, I suppose like what sort of mentality do you go into like just torrenting thing after thing looking for, right? Like how much do you sort through versus what you end up including, for instance?
That is a ongoing struggle in my head as to how much time to spend collecting versus processing. for years and years before Museum of Home Video, I just kept collecting with no real purpose in mind other than like I was good at collecting and torrenting. So I might as well just keep going. And now that I have 50, 60-ish terabytes of stuff, I had always joked with some colleagues at Cinefamily about I'll get to watch all this stuff when I retire. I'm like, I guess I'll just keep collecting. And then one day after I magically was sitting on the beach in Hawaii with my margarita and my tablet in my other hand, what am I going to finally watch? And I realized, well, there's never been a better time than now to just actually watch the things I'm downloading. So the approach I take to, yes, because the canvas is so large, basically all of recorded human history and all of broadcast media, it's just whatever comes my way. I don't get too particular about like grabbing stuff in a folder because it amused me one night in 2022 and then one day in 2025, I'll come back to that one. I'm like, oh, right, I should cut that one now. So it's only like it's what is in front of me. There's no deep dives ever because there's just too much stuff. And so what I actually do is I just skip a stone across an ocean hoping to reach the other side. And that is the storytelling, the strange archival world that I've created, and also the UHF MTV VJ style presentation of it.
And I suppose that that informed your editing style quite a bit. How did you develop that editing style over time? Was it just what people responded to, or did you find that like something about the stuff that you were collecting lent itself to your editing style in a certain way, or what was that process like to develop?
It started out like I'm just going to delete all the things that are boring. I'm only going to show not boring things. The idea from the beginning was like all killer, no filler. Can I actually achieve that? I mostly think I do. And so literally the way I watch things for potential use on the show is I watch them for the first time in Adobe Premiere. And the second I'm starting to watch it is the second I'm starting to edit it. That is the only way to tackle this amount of stuff. Rarely do a second draft unless it's something that goes horribly wrong. Cause there's no time to revise because there's a show every week. One of the reasons I love, like nighttime talk show clips so much is that they had 5 days of a week of show to produce. And so they don't really care if something weird happens because they won't remember it the next day. And that's the beauty of the collector circuit is that people find things, digitize them and upload them and other people download them. And I can do this with it once I've downloaded it. And find those moments of humanity. Like showbiz is so polished that when something weird happens on a talk show, it's like humanity poking through. So those are also moments that I like. I find those really revelatory. Like whenever, what's her face? Jennifer Tilly. Whenever Jennifer Tilly is on a talk show, hit play on that YouTube clip. You know, it's like humanity pokes through in weird ways.
Sorry, I have to ask then. Because you've mentioned humanity a couple of times, and that's what really attracts me to the Museum of Home Video as well, right? Is this idea that like every clip, whether you're playing it for like 6 seconds or whether it's a bigger showcase, like at some point this was somebody's whole life or job, right? Like somebody really cared about putting something into this, and to see such like decontextualized cross sections of that is so fascinating. And there's something kind of heartwarming about it. How do you feel about AI? I would imagine you probably have some pretty like, do you think about that much and about how that's informing the future of editing and content creation? Because it scares the shit out of me, right? Like this idea that like so much more of the, like the sort of ephemeral we might encounter in the future is something that humans never touched. Do you think about that much, or do you feel like, do you have a more optimistic outlook on that than I do, maybe?
AI is a very complicated question. Of course, I have a lot of thoughts about it. I don't ever want to watch stuff created by AI specifically because I'm not seeing any evidence of storytelling yet. I'm seeing tropes, but tropes don't equal a movie. It's like one layer of the movie. AI is already affecting the way that I do my show because of the YouTube algorithm. You know, that's AI as well, really. And I rely on it each night as kind of a roulette wheel to give me something that may or may not work for the show. Sometimes it works. So I guess I'm pro AI in that regard, even though I think before too long, there's going to be some copyright law lawyer shit that might completely stifle the growth of it as a commercial product. Like if I was a filmmaker, I would be terrified that all I've done is become grist for. It's why I'm not on social media. I mean, I have accounts, but I don't really post anything anywhere because it's going to make somebody else rich. Like, what the fuck do I care about it? I've already got my own medium to worry about. But it has to happen because of promotion. It's such an ill cycle. Anyways, what the fuck was I talking about? AI. I think that people, by and large, aren't going to want content made by AI. It's going to be quite obvious. It's like, would you rather have a whiskey that some dude made in their house or that like a professional distillery did? Like, you want the pros to come in with their touches, their human touches, and like make it a nice whiskey. Anyway, I'm being very flowery. AI is very scary. It's like one of the rare times when something that's in a movie could possibly happen in real life. You know, we all grew up with the nuke fear and the Terminator mythos. So could that happen? Maybe. I don't know. I don't like it.
There we fucking go. No, it's, I mean, it's less just like a guy in his basement making you gin and tonic. And it's like the guy least qualified to make a gin and tonic, Googling the first recipe for gin and tonic and then just making it exactly by the, I have to use it for work sometimes. I have a boring ass job and I'm not excited about it at all. But I see, like, again, it's that balance. I use a form of AI to like remove silence from tracks when I'm producing this very podcast. There's like filters I apply that are reliant on a certain form of artificial intelligence. So yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than love hate. It's like, we have to yet see it's in a nation stage sort of thing. But like the conversation, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and we have to be prepared to strangle it in the crib if it gets too out of hand.
Butler and Jihad. That's right.
Since we're talking about such contemporary stuff, I wanted to ask, because a lot of what Aaron sort of broke the water on the conversation of like what decades have, you know, you've pulled from and, you know, how the historical information plays into programming for Museum of Home Video, et cetera. Is it hard? Do you even try to find modern stuff for Museum of Home Video? Is it like harder than finding old stuff? I guess there's this idea that I had spinning around in my head, like modern, and Harry touched on it too, modern streaming culture is sort of like streamlined a whole lot of content production. And I say content production as somebody who does content marketing, but like literally just content, like visual and audio content is all so, or can all seem so flat and so intentional that there's so little, like a lot of the benefit of MOHV stuff that I've like been privy to anyway, is the benefit of hindsight. And it makes me wonder if it's hard to, or if you even try to find stuff that's modern, contemporary things that could become part of MOHV's programming. Is it tougher? Do you even try that? Is that a thing that crosses your mind ever?
Yeah, it crosses my mind all the time. I try very hard to balance the show. If I'm like, for example, I've just made four things in a row that are all 70s. Well, fuck, I should probably do something more recent just to offset that. And Ring Ring is one of those things. It's brand spanking new. There's a fair amount of YouTube creators that I follow because I, you know, that's my TV. I don't really watch TV shows anymore. Yeah, I think about it all the time. And I feel like that's the only way for my show to stay relevant, because if it was just Gen X things, I'd get pretty boring quickly. That's, I think, the reason why a lot of people come back, is that you never know what you're going to get, but you know it's not going to be filler.
As I understand, you're not missing a whole lot from modern television, except Shogun. People tell me that show's really good, haven't yet seen it.
My boyfriend introduced me to Young Sheldon. I thought that was actually pretty well done. I've never seen The Big Bang Theory. I have no interest, but that show was pretty well done.
You are maybe a diamond in the rough. Somebody who had not seen anything from Big Bang Theory, but came to Young Sheldon and enjoyed. I guess I have no view into the psyche of any folk who watch either of those shows, because I think my mom watched Big Bang Theory at one point, and it was just hard to ever contextualize anything, any spinoff from that, as anything other than a show my mom likes. So I don't know. So like you talked about how Ring Ring is obviously part of the, you got to balance the old shit with the new stuff, so to speak. What else is being created today that you see could have the potential to expand the purview of the museum, like in the way that Ring Ring seems to have at least pushed, like, oh, this is a new, like you said, brand spanking new. It's a new channel, it's a new piece, but it's also like a new format you're diving into. It's a new channel, literally. You're pulling from compilers of Ring, doorbell cam footage and other like home security type stuff. What else is happening in like the media landscape that's making you think I might be able to, not necessarily like just till that, but that might be a vein for you to tap at some point?
Oh, I'm deeply into watching strange food YouTube. I think that just endlessly fascinates me. It's the best parts of Idiocracy come alive. I think when you go into that treasure trove of content that is food creator YouTube. Not so much mukbang. I find that kind of repellent, and I'm not a big ASMR person anyway. But just the kind of the limitless possibilities for smashing all genres. It is kind of like an everything everywhere all at once, but like, using real people. I do not like fast food reviews. I think that's cheap and stupid, and it's like there's nothing to be said. I do not like content where people are sitting in their car filming themselves. I think that's useless. I think the most cinematic presentations of food content, that's what gets me interested. Not necessarily cooking, but just like strange things related to food.
So not mukbang, but a form of food porn then? What are we talking? I guess I'm not part of that sphere.
Creative ideas in like bringing this kind of cooking together with this kind of cooking, or people who take Verite documentaries of street vendors. I get lost in that for hours. You know, go to the night market in Thailand, and I'm like, and like 4 hours later, I look up and it's like sunrise.
I will say I've seen more than my fair share of like Thailand and Punjab street food being made, and I just think every single piece, I would eat that. And then I think maybe
it's just so fun to watch too.
It really is. Well, let's tie the conversation a little bit back to the repertory cinema angle again, pulling back to Trilon's bread and butter, so to speak. Maybe talk a little bit about if this incites any thoughts for you at all, like the lines between and the contrast and comparison of repertory cinema to download culture. Obviously, they're both about preserving things. They're both about recontextualizing things and sort of like making them available and sort of like presenting them in a way that the modern audiences can or would want to consume. Do you see a line between those worlds? Is it a big, you know, solid line? Is it, I mean, obviously both of your roles, your primary roles right now, are like complementary in that respect, but I guess that's what makes it so interesting to hear your thoughts about if between repertory cinema and download culture, there's like shared skills, shared benefits, shared like discipline there. What do you think about that sort of comparison?
Well, definitely the problem solving element. Being a programmer, part of it is public facing. Part of it is, yeah, I got to get that invoice out to that person. But then there's also the Columbo style detective work that it takes to get something on screen sometimes. You know, if it's Top Gun, you just email Paramount and you say, hey, I want to do a show of Top Gun. It's easy. But if it's some fucking thing from some country, or if it's like some fucking movie where the guy died and he was the only person you could email to book the movie, you have to go on these long journeys into like dark, murky territory. I'm using a lot of metaphors, but sometimes you have to email a lot of people to figure out where something is. And that's what I do on Museum of Home Video. I try really hard to find things wherever I can. And so the Columbo part of it, and also trying to, in both, I think it's about trying to keep whatever the material is relevant to whatever is happening off screen. Not like it needs to tie into a political message, but just like literally how does it relate to people's lives? There's a whole lot of older films that I wouldn't show anymore because I don't think it relates to what people want to have out as their evening's entertainment. You know, like a lot of drive-in movies from the 70s are just like, you could show them and you could remind people, oh, right, you know, this was made at a different time, but it's like, as a programmer, do I want to grip the table as some thing rolls on screen where I have to explain it in the lobby to someone about why I decided to choose this movie and it completely was the wrong thing for them that evening? You know, like, if a movie has more than one sexual assault scene, well, maybe I'll show something else, you know, like, so I do a weekly show in LA at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown LA. And the movies I try to pick are things that I don't have to explain in the lobby to someone afterwards. And when I'm putting on the show on my channel every week on Tuesdays, I'm also thinking about the same thing. I just have to keep it relevant to people's lives. That's why I'm trying to do more stuff that is current mixed in with the 70s, like, you know, stuff. And it just has to make people think that they're part of they're part of the storytelling rather than like some, you know, here's 2 hours of the match game or whatever, which I do. But, you know, you have to mix it up. You have to make it relevant to what people want to get out of it.
Right. You do. But when you do, you know how that's going to be perceived. You know that, like, that is, you're doing it intentionally, I would assume. Like, is it happening at the same time? I know Cody's got a ticket, but I don't know if I have mine. Joe Dante's movie Orgy, how I think you've talked about how that was pulled down from 7 hours to like the current 4 hours it is or whatever, and how it was encouraged to keep changing and developing. It seems like it's more just about that, like creating for what's going to work, or at least knowing if this isn't going to work, I will need to explain something. You know, there will need to be some sort of conversation with the audience about what the intent here was versus just immediate auditory, you know, butter that melts in their minds, just easy consumption type thing. I guess that wasn't so much a question, but.
So the movie Orgy, put together by Joe Dante and John Davison. Dante is, of course, the director of Gremlins and Inner Space and Explorers and The Burbs and Matinee and the movies I'm forgetting. And John Davison was the producer of Airplane and RoboCop and Starship Troopers and Top Secret. So these are guys who, like, you know, they're our kind of moviegoer, right? They, in the late 60s, cobbled basically what was the Museum of Home Video, but in the 60s, on film, 60mm film prints. They did these touring shows where it was like, let's play a little bit of a cheesy sci-fi horror movie, and then let's cut to some commercials, and let's go back to something else. But they were doing it with dueling film projectors in front of a live audience, and they could watch the audience and say, okay, how's this movie? Like, they call out, like, are people still feeling this movie? And if people go like, no, then they literally just switch to the reel of commercials that they loaded up on the other projector. And then they'd run that for a few minutes while they loaded up some other movie. And then they switch back to the movie and like, okay, let's see how this works. And so the final 4.5 hour version of the movie Orgy was showing at the Trilon that we've preserved through AGFA. It represents Joe Dante's best hopes and dreams and wishes for the movie Orgy. It's just like the 4.5 hours that he knew worked, like was killer. All killer, no filler. Yeah. And it's no surprise that I grew up watching his movies. Like, I went out to the theater as a young child to see like The Burbs and Inner Space and Gremlins 2. So, you know, he's in my brain as much as Weird Al and UHF and all that.
You know, I got to admit something real quick. I haven't seen too many of Joe Dante's movies. The movie that comes to mind when you say his name, Small Soldiers. 1998. Fucking love that movie. Ever since I was a kid, it still sticks in my mind. I watched it again a couple of years ago, and it still hits in a different way, but it still hits.
One of the quintessential 1990s movies.
I think. So fucking wonderful, this movie. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones.
It's a really good example of a Joe Dante movie because it's like kind of weird and darker than you would expect, but it has like all of that like humor to it. It's great stuff.
Well, yeah, the general is just like the most over like played version of a militaristic, you know, psychopath possible. And he uses the phrase, I put this in my Letterboxd review years ago. He uses the phrase, I want it mobile and I want it lethal. Plays it completely straight. Like as a comedic line, he plays it completely straight. I think everybody was just on board with that movie. I don't know if there's been a movie like it since.
Early on, I asked you what kept the audience coming back, but I'm super fascinated in what keeps you coming back, right? Like I said, this has to be a lot of work, right? Like I not to get to, I promised the woo-woo questions, Jason, but like I see you sort of like doing this week in and week out is like, it's like jazz, right? Like you're going through it. You're like trying to find what works, what doesn't. You're improvising. You're putting things together. What is it about that process that appeals to you so much that you want to keep doing it week after week? Like what's exciting about it?
You're right. I do think it is like jazz. I have said that before. I treat Adobe Premiere like a trumpet. A lot of notes you can hit with it. I'm a bass player. I grew up, I was in jazz band in high school. So I think that most of my edits are, you know, musician-like. I don't think I would have all the staccato rhythms that I have in my editing if I didn't know how to like play a musical instrument. But what keeps me coming back to making this quantity of stuff every week is that it is actually my video therapy. Especially during the lockdown, I was like, well, if there's nothing else I can do, I'm definitely going to do this. I'm going to explore my past based upon my media diet and what can I cough up that would be relevant for people to watch. I found that very therapeutic. And also the appointment viewing during the lockdown era was therapeutic, I think, for a large number of the audience. Just it gave them an anchor in their week to smile about when a lot of shit wasn't smile worthy. It's my happy place. I'm never giggling and laughing so much as when I'm making a silly edit that I know, like this certain edit point will connect with, I know that there's a laugh line there because if it makes me laugh that much, it's got to make at least one other person laugh that much. And I've trusted my instincts at this point to just guide me to what I think is funny, not what I think is like coolest or just what's cinematic and what's funny. I think those are two good barometers.
Super, super generic question here, but I'm wondering if you can give some examples of things that you've found for kind of shows that you've made for the Museum of Home Video in the past that have been just gems that to you were like, can't believe I found this. This is like something incredible. I need to put this in here. Can you give, you know, an example or however many you want, I guess, of things that really, yeah.
Yeah, I really love the commercial pieces that I do, compilations of just straight up commercials. And what I look for are the ones that make me ask myself, how did this get through multiple rounds of creative development where there's so much money at stake? Those are the ones that usually make it in. And I really love game show clips when it's high drama. I think that game shows pre-reality TV were one of the best ways to see real people on television. Because you just had housewives and like lawn furniture salesmen and like, you know, movie theater managers. Like somehow they ended up as like the contestants. And when there's something that goes wrong or there's some high drama on a game show, there's nothing better. Because they didn't wake up that day thinking they were going to have such an emotional pummeling. and it's for something as banal as like a game show that airs at 10 a.m. with commercials on it. So I find the game show edits really fun. As I mentioned before, the talk show edits where it's unscripted, unrehearsed, unpredictable moments. I think those have real relevance. And I really like pointing people to those. Again, when I cut a movie down to 12 minutes, it's for a good reason. It's because I really, really don't think you should watch the full movie. A lot of people, when they watch those segments, those are called, I call that style of editing masterpiece theater, because it's just like, I'm giving you the great stuff. Maybe you're only getting a fraction of what the movie part of it is, but that doesn't matter. I really did watch the whole movie and it's mostly boring. So please believe me when I say don't go and watch the whole movie. Like, I did an edit of the Jerky Boys movie that was only like 2 minutes. It's every time that the main character is just obsessed with ass and every prank call he makes has some like ass joke. You know, I was about to do an impression, but it's too dumb to even do an impression of. You don't need to know what the movie's about. You just need to know that this movie is relevant for this one reason. So I hope people pay attention to this.
Also, a bunch of movies you could save that way. Like I just listened to a podcast about Cool as Ice, the Vanilla Ice movie, and I kept thinking there's like probably a really fascinating 11-minute movie somewhere in that movie. And I bet that's true of a lot of movies That's a lot of bad so movies. Funny. Yeah. Well, arguably.
I think every time that I grew up watching a lot of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and every time I was like, I should just watch the full version of this movie. I was always like, they really did something by editing that down and putting in all those jokes, because some of those do not work without that humorous kind of scaffolding around it. So you're doing a public service, Brett, is what I'm saying.
Thank you. And I think, and for those, yes, for those who participate in the chat box during the show, it's not everybody. It's probably like a third of the people who watch the show. The chat box is their chance to replicate that experience. You know, you can silently watch it and make a funny joke and like participate in a community of people who are all experiencing this thing on like an extra dimension.
Harry, I'm going to take one of your questions. I think it's one of the less woo-woo, but it seems to kind of fit here. It's clearly given you, like, working with MOHV and going through, I presume, lifetimes of content, both in, you know, all of your film adjacent roles, has clearly given you like a very honed sense of what works, what doesn't, you know, how to rectify that when it's not. What else do you think this is doing to your brain? You seem pretty well like adjusted. You're very well put together. You know exactly how to appear on like in conversation. You're yes anding. You're doing like way better than I would assume somebody who has literally combed through more than like a person could ever watch of content, or like briefed it, like you said, watching some stuff on an iPad on vacation. What is that doing? Have you ever thought about like the impact?
Well, it's like I just watched Dune, and I feel like being hooked up to the drip feed of ephemera that you are has to be like the Reverend Mother shit that Jessica goes through, where like she receives all of the like generational memories of everyone who came before. Yeah, so like just to follow up with Jason, like what do you think that's doing to you? Do you think it's what's going on with it?
Well, first, I grew up with Dune. It's very funny that you mentioned that. Just as a personal aside, Dune was like the first movie that I got David Lynch's Dune was the first I got obsessed with when my family got cable. It was like 85, 86, somewhere in there. And it was the first movie that I saw as a little kid that made me understand that there was a film director. Like the movie was so strange that I thought it has to be there's got to be a person who's responsible for how strange this is. It turns out that was true. And of course, I got obsessed with him in short order directly after that. I had a couple friends in elementary school, precocious friends, that were in love with Twin Peaks, and we were like 10 years old, and it was on at that time. And so I got into it through them. What is it doing to me? It's making me more aware of my surroundings, I think. It's helping me sharpen my ideas of what I think is right and wrong in the world. It is making me understand why people do things, and it's usually for money. Like, you can start to, I'm not saying that, you know, people need to read my stuff as like a social primer, but there's just things I'm learning about the world that you can find in its discarded trash. You know, there's always the metaphor of like, you know, when the Zipzorb aliens come, they're going to look in our landfills and they'll find out more about us there than anything. It's the same. I'm Zipzorping around and I'm like in the 28th century video editor. And, you know, look at these humans, we're humans learning about our culture. And yes, it's like I should put the screen down, which is why I'm going on tour a lot more this year, because I want to get out there and travel and, you know, spend slightly less time in front of the screen and force people to watch my shit on a screen.
This is the appointment viewing of appointment viewing is what it is. Well, I do want to take too much more of your time, Brett. I know we've taken almost an hour of it, and that honestly was a really great way to remind folks. You can check things out at trilon.org. Ring Ring is playing March 15th through 17th, if I remember correctly. Check it out. It's that weekend anyway. And if you're listening to this beyond then, go to museumofhomevideo.com to check things out. I do want to get a couple of, if you have just a few more minutes, Brett, some, frankly, I would call them dumb questions, because I came up with the first one. Again, I was listening to the Screenslate podcast, and somebody brought up a movie that I had just seen recently and felt pretty fondly of. So I must ask, when's the last time you watched Southland Tales, and how long do you think you'd need to properly reevaluate it before watching it again?
Well, I saw it in, it must have been 2006. Saw it at a multiplex. Didn't understand it at all. Left thinking that I had seen something that I just purely didn't get at all, which was rare because I expected to have some kind of take on it other than like, this sucks. But that's what I walked away thinking. I was like, this fucking sucks. And I didn't like Donnie Darko at the time, but I've since come around on that. I think it's a pretty charming movie and it's pretty harmless. It has a great soundtrack. I get why people are into that. South End Tales, I did a screening of it at Alamo downtown. It was about a year ago. And I was able to reevaluate it, and I think that it's now a watchable movie, but still not a good movie. I think that it makes its points, and it's very effective in the specific kind of movie satire that it's doing, but it is based upon other kinds of movie satires that were not financially successful and were huge career-ruining bombs. So he emulated that career trajectory, and he got it. He got what he wanted. And then he made The Box. We're talking about Richard Kelly. And then he made The Box, which is, if Southland Tales hadn't ruined his career, The Box did. And he was just like, that's the kind of movie he wanted to make. So I appreciate Southland Tales as like a David Lynch's Dune style, like fumble. But at the same time, it is kind of a unique object. And what better way to see it than with 50 people and with a beer in your hand?
It was a beautiful harakiri of a movie, I think. It was just perfectly executed. Anybody else have what they would, and I say dumb questions, I mean, just mean less on the we're getting new insights here and more just fun things. Any questions anybody wants to ask before we start to exhume to this episode?
This is probably not the most couth of questions, I suppose, but like, I feel like everybody I know who's into torrenting has some like real weird stories. And I bet you found some like incredibly weird shit in your time. And I would wonder if like, do you have any particularly memorable experiences finding something that was just like opening the Ark of the Covenant or something, or just like something that no human eyes were ever meant to see?
Oh yeah, there's quite a few. So I used to, I have a lot more of these stories from my cine family time, which was like 08 to 15. It was like a golden age of torrenting for me, and it was mainly because of a coworker of mine named Tom Fitzgerald. And pre-torrenting culture, I knew him because he ran an e-commerce site of bootlegs, weird things that never had a release. He was like the last generation of collectors to participate in that like mail order bootleg time period. And one that he just went on and on about that we eventually got to watch was Fuck, the Brazilian Wonder Midget. And there was an entire school of filmmaking in Brazil in the 60s and 70s called Boca de Lijo, something like that. Translates to mouth of garbage. And it was an entire filmmaking wave. It was like Brazilian New Wave, but an offshoot of it that it was specifically like in Sao Paulo and in the slums. And it was like real, you know, kind of like Godardian French New Wave, exciting action, but it was done on like the street level in Brazil. And a lot of the movies surfaced as like pornos or just like exploitation movies. And I have no idea what the actual title of this movie is, but the bootleg title is Fuck, the Brazilian Wonder Midget. And the little person who's the star of the movie, his name is Trombino. And in this movie, Trombino gets flushed down the toilet, and then he emerges on the other side of the city and has like a Candide Voltaire style series of adventures. But it is also a porno. And it is like shot on 16. And when I was watching it with no subtitles, I was like, this cannot be real. This is like what they are showing on the channel in the movie Videodrome. Like, this shouldn't be happening, right? This is like the programming on channel 83 late at night is this movie. So every time I think of like my experiences torrenting and all the fun times I've had, I think about Trombino. And this stupid Brazilian porno with no subtitles.
That's exactly the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
I have to find out if that one's on Letterboxd so I can log it and make it uncomfortable for everybody. Well, Brett, I I really do appreciate your time. Thank you so much for carving out a little bit for us. Reminder to everybody that you can find tickets to Ring Ring and guide to infomercials at trilon.org. And actually, well beyond the scope of this episode, you can find a lot of cool shit at trilon.org. You can find Museum of Home Video at museumofhomevideo.com. Brett, one more time. Where can people find you? I know you said you're not on social. If people want to find out what you're doing now and whatever you want to plug at the moment, what should they do?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, they could go to our Instagram. I mean, we have social handles for the channel and the show. It's just Museum of Home Video, at Museum of Home Video on Instagram. And we may do a TikTok soon. I don't know. We've talked about it. But something I want to point out, like, we've been talking a lot of highfalutin theoretical stuff. The show is very fun. Above all else, I think that, like, it's a hell of a lot of fun. That's what keeps people coming back. It's just like television with all the boring parts cut out. I'm too high. Sorry.
Anyway. that's our fault, by the way. That's something we're also guilty of on our episode, but, like, rest assured that this is going to be super fun, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, like, who doesn't love, like, watching 15 different television stations at once, which is basically the effect of the show.
We'll all get there someday. Well, thank you again, listener, for joining. Thank you, Brett, for being on. We're going to say goodnight. Quick reminder, Brett, we're not going to close out just after the outro. But thank you so much for listening to Trilove. Find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. Find me, Jason Dabness, on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
Thanks so much for your time, Brett. Really looking forward to the show. I've been Cody Narveson. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson and on Twitter at Cody_BH.
Yeah, I've been Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at Punishtake.
And my name is Aaron. Thanks again, Brett. You can find me on Twitter at RBPlease.